Hi, we're Eleanor and Carrie. We're the hosts of the Good Robot Podcast, and join us as we ask the experts, what is good technology? Is it even possible? And what does feminism have to bring to this conversation? If you want to learn more about today's topic, head over to our website, where we've got a full transcript of the episode and a specially curated reading list with work by or picked by our experts. But until then, sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode.
Today we're talking to Professor Jason Lewis, the University Research Chair in Computational Media and the Indigenous Future Imaginary at Concordia University in Montreal. Jason is Cherokee, Hawaiian, and Samoan, and an expert in Indigenous design and AI. He's the founder of OBX Labs for Experimental Media and the co-director of a number of research groups, such as Aboriginal Territories and Cyberspace, Skins Workshops on Aboriginal Storytelling and Video Game Design, and the Initiative for Indigenous Futures. In this episode, we discuss how Indigenous communities think about what it means for humans and AI to coexist, why we need to rethink what it means to be an intelligent machine, and why mainstream Western modes of building technology might actually land us with Skynet. We hope you enjoy the show.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Could you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do and what brings you to the topic of Indigenous epistemologies and technology?
I'm Jason Edward Lewis. I am a professor of design and computation arts at Concordia University in Montreal. And I, in general, look at the intersection of sort of computational media and how it affects the ways in which we speak to each other and the ways in which we interact with each other. I came to this topic of Indigenous epistemology and artificial intelligence really through, you know, probably 15 years of specifically looking at how Indigenous people were using digital technologies to tell our stories. And then sort of in a more general sense and on a longer time frame, thinking about how these communication technologies were affecting the ways in which we engage with each other and the ways in which we understand one another and also understand the world around us. So thinking a lot about how the medium affects the message.
Fantastic. So we are the Good Robot. That's our provocation. And we ask everyone, what is good technology? What does it look like? And we're thinking about good for whom, you know. So how are you thinking about good technology or what good technology might be and how we should work towards it?
So these days, I really see good technology as technology that is responsive to local conditions, that we have we've benefited mightily from technologies designed to scale over tens of thousands and millions and hundreds of millions of people, without a doubt. But as we've scaled technology like that, we've overwritten a lot of the particular things that are of importance to local communities. And we can define local communities in lots of different ways. So when I talk about local communities, I'm really talking about Indigenous communities. And sometimes those Indigenous communities are on their territory. So it's really easy to see the sort of where the idea of their community and where they're at come together. But sometimes they're Indigenous communities that are, say, in an urban setting, or they're international Indigenous communities. So it's me as a Hawaiian, a Kanaka Maoli person in Montreal talking to, you know, somebody who is Cree from in Winnipeg talking to somebody who is Maori, you know, in New Zealand. Right. But we do have community, right? There's a commonality of sort of interests and values and things that we're fighting for so that we can think about what that means on a community level. So in order to develop good technology, it's really about how do you pay attention to what the people who are using it, what they really want to do, and getting away from assumptions about universal users, even about sort of like kind of limited number of, say, you know, user profiles or things like that. But, and partially because those are very individually based, right? So most of the work that I'm familiar with anyways, from computer-human interaction work, from interaction design fields. You know, they really try to reify up to a small number of potential users so they could design something that theoretically is going to appeal to the largest number of users possible. And I'm only saying that because I'm trying to be like, you know, academic careful, but screw that. None of them really take into account the cultural dimension of people's lives. And in fact, they make an assumption that the cultural aspect of people's life is a dimension, right? It's just one facet among sort of a bunch of different things that create who they are and what drives them. And I've increasingly come to the conclusion that culture is the central part, that we cannot understand individuals without understanding their culture or the culture that they come out of, as well as the cultures that they are maybe, say, aspiring to inhabit, right? So it's not an inherently conservative way of looking at things, meaning that, like, okay, so, you know, you grew up as an adopted, you know, Kanaka Maoli person in Northern California, and that is going to determine everything about you for the rest of your life, right? That's part of what determines me, but sort of everything that's happened to me since then and the different communities I've stepped into since then also make a difference there. So figuring out how to take all these wonderful tools that we developed that, you know, often get a lot of their power from abstraction and scale, and thinking about how we can counterbalance that with actually paying attention to specific circumstances where the culture and the community that you're part of play a central role.
Absolutely. And there's so many different fascinating threads to draw out there. And I think your reflections on, you know, who this kind of anonymized abstract user is and how that, you know, often totally ignores, you know, the realities of how people are using technology, but also, you know, can be super embedded with all kinds of different sort of patriarchal norms. Like I'm thinking, of course, of, you know, growing up, how the iTunes account was always synced to the idea of the household, right? That you had a household account and all the norms that get kind of embedded in that. But something else I thought that your answer kind of brought up was the ideas that you touched on in a piece that you co-authored, which is fantastic. Highly recommend to all of our listeners, a piece called Making Kin with the Machines, which thinks about the ways in which indigenous epistemologies are so much better at these kinds of relationalities between humans and non-humans. So I was wondering, for our listeners, would you mind telling them about your work in this piece and why you think indigenous epistemologies are so important in this space?
Absolutely. I find it super exciting. So Making Kin with the Machines is an essay that I co-authored with Noelani Arista, who was a professor of history at the University of Hawaii at Manoa at the time. And she's a Hawaiian language and archive specialist. Arch Machawis, who is a Cree performance artist based out of Toronto, who has been thinking and making around the concepts of what does it mean to indigenize this digital technology since the early 90s. And then Suzanne Kite, who is a PhD student with whom I work, who is Lakota, and she's really interested in how Lakota ways of being and ways of knowing can be expressed in the design of the instruments that she makes. She makes her own instruments for performance, and then also in the performances themselves. So we got together, long story short, is that when Suzanne joined me here at Concordia to start her PhD studies, we did a couple directed readings that were really digging into indigenous epistemologies, as particularly as they relate to kinship, right? And non-humans. So what does it mean to structure your ways of knowing and sort of what you look to as knowledge and what you accept as knowledge is to structure that in a way that takes into account non-humans, right? And it takes into account your relationship with non-humans. And then Noe, who I know from a series of workshops that we've done in Honolulu, approached me about this competition to respond to an essay by Joey Ito, the former director of MIT Media Lab, where he was encouraging people to think critically about AI and about these sort of universalizing tendencies and these extractive tendencies. So we pulled Archer into that conversation and we're like, we have something to say about this. So the essay is structured on a general level. So making some claims about indigenous epistemologies in general and their ability to incorporate ways of talking about non-humans in a respectful and generative way. And also acknowledging that these epistemologies are located in specific communities and that they differ. There's commonalities, but there's differences too. So the essay itself makes this kind of general argument, but then actually drops down into, let's talk about Hawaiian approaches towards kinship and non-humans, Cree attitudes, Lakota attitudes, and using examples from the language, from cultural practices, from knowledge practices to illuminate both where things were different between these three different cultural perspectives and also where they were the same. And one of the core critiques is that, you know, at least, you know, we're operating out a common language of English. So let's say like the English framework coming out of North America and England, that the ability to talk rationally about non-humans is almost non-existent, meaning that, you know, man has been placed at the height in the center of our world, coming from this tradition, and everything else is relegated to subordination and to lesser than-ness. And that there's very little desire and lots of obstacles to actually looking towards or looking to non-humans for knowledge, because it's assumed that only humans generate and hold knowledge. So in our language, that gets expressed so that anytime we start talking about, you know, the trees or having a discourse with the fish or something like that, it automatically kind of gets pushed into this either kind of spiritual register or this like kind of kook register, right? It's like, that's not how rational scientists talk, right? So it makes it really difficult to see what those relationships might be, right? And the fact is, and this part of the point of the essay, is that those relationships are incredibly diverse, right? So as Suzanne likes to say, she said, well, you know, according to my people, there's some, all stones are capable of speaking, but only some will speak to you, right? And then there's other traditions that are like, well, stones aren't really our relations, right? We recognize that they're part of our world, but that we don't make relationships with them, right? So that's part of what's really important is, you know, as soon as you start talking about moving that way, then the mainstream discourse assumes that it's all just the same thing. You're just going to be talking to the fish and hanging out with the trees and da da da, and it's all going to be, everybody's going to be sort of equal in a sense, or everything. But that's not the case, right? These languages and these cultures have an incredibly rich and diverse sort of like topologies of those relationships. And so much of that relationality is dependent upon protocol, right? So how do you talk to them? Who talks to them, right? What stories exist in your community about previous conversations with them, right? And what do you need to understand from those previous conversations before you try to have, you know, a conversation or a discourse or a relationship with them? So trying to highlight how the language themselves in particular retains that flexibility, that nuance, and also that imperative, right, is that there are things embedded in the language that lead you to that place, right? Whereas I would argue that the way that, let's just say scientific English to make it simple, right, operates is it actually very much leads you away from that, right? It's like, this is not a topic for conversation. So making kin with the machines was really our statement of like, first of all, there are important relationships that we have with other beings in this world. Secondly, in the Western tradition, we have lost the ability to engage in that discourse in a meaningful way, particularly when it comes to science and technology. And here are some examples of particular indigenous cultures that have retained that ability in their language, but also in their ontology, epistemology, cosmology. So in their sense of who they are, in their ways of making sense with the world, and how they place themselves in the cosmos.
Fantastic. And I really liked as well what you were saying about the ways in which these knowledge systems are portrayed as somehow not rational, or they're portrayed as immediately as spiritual. And a lot of my own work is in Asian diaspora studies. And I think you see this a lot with, for example, Chinese medicine, that's either fetishized as this kind of deeply spiritual practice, or it's treated as junk science. And there doesn't seem to be any middle ground there for thinking about, you know, can we not have, you know, knowledge systems that aren't exactly the same as, you know, Western science, but be taken as sort of robust systems of knowledge in their own right.
Yeah, and part of the legacy of the of sort of both the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment is a displacement of all other knowledge systems, right? Like, both of them make very strong claims about their monotheistic claims. Right? They're like, this is the only system of belief that is available to you. Right? And if you go and dabble in those other systems of belief, you're a heretic. And you're actually unclean and impure, and you don't deserve to be in this system. And part of the reason why we present the argument of making kin and the machines the way we do is to say, well, you can operate in multiple knowledge systems at the same time. Right? Like, you can operate, like all of us, you know, so two of us on that essay are academics, two of them are artists. I'm an artist as well, but like, we operate in the academic world as well as these worlds, and they operate in the art world and having to navigate all of that crazy capitalistness, and also operate in, you know, the framework that comes from, you know, their communities.
Absolutely. And something that I really liked that you kind of wrote in some of your other work was the way in which engaging with these kinds of abundances of knowledge systems also allows us to think about intelligence differently. So going from a model of thinking about impoverished intelligence to abundant intelligences. So again, could you describe a bit for our listeners what you mean by thinking through that kind of transition?
Sometimes things in the world of technology are complicated and need careful explaining. Sometimes they just need a little hard truth.
I don't think anyone is going to buy a banana with crypto at any point in the foreseeable future.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Slate's What Next TBD, your clear-eyed guide to technology, power, and the future. Friday and Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So from impoverished intelligence to abundant intelligence, it was an attempt on my part to try to identify in a concise way what I thought was very problematic about the current mainstream research and development around artificial intelligence. And that is that it has arguably collapsed to a very narrow approach to the challenge of intelligence. So machine learning has sort of eaten the AI world and made it so that has become identified with artificial intelligence. Even though practitioners, machine learning practitioners, will, when they actually have to sit down and write a scientific paper, will make it very clear, right, that this is just one approach. However, when they're talking to the press or trying to get money, that distinction goes out the window. Right? Because people are excited about funding AI, but they're not excited about statistics, right? Which is basically what machine learning is. You know, and also I'd read reading up on this stuff all the time, but in particular, there was a special issue of the Journal of Artificial General Intelligence that came out, I think, maybe 2 years ago, where that was, they had one contributor who basically wrote a journal article making an argument for how we should define artificial intelligence. And then there was a series of responses from people working in the field. And I got it and I was like, okay, this is going to be great because I'm going to see now there's a whole range of responses in one place and I'm going to be proven wrong, right? I'm going to see that there's like some diversity here about how to approach this question of what intelligence is. And I was wrong. Right? Is almost everybody essentially converged on a definition of intelligence, which is probably best summarized as sort of rational goal seeking for self-service, right? And there were a few dissenting voices. Roger Schenck, who's one of the early AI, or sort of second wave AI pioneers, who's a bit of a crank in the field, and had a cranky response where he was basically like, this is not artificial intelligence, right? This is interesting work, but it's not artificial intelligence, and we should just stop calling it that. And it made me realize that the definition they're operating on is incredibly narrow. It does not take into account so many different ways in which we behave intelligently in the world. And this is, I mean, I am not the first person to make this argument by far. Like, if you go back to, I think, the 80s when Marvin Minsky published The Society of the Mind, right? Some of the conversations around that time were really arguing about different kinds of intelligences and how we need to understand them and how they operate differently. And then thinking about how do we formalize that and then make it computable so we can embed it in machines. You know, there's lots of discussions around that, but most of those got pushed aside with machine learning, 15 years ago, sort of really taking off when they had the right equipment to make it really feasible. And it seemed just so dangerous, right? It seemed it's akin to saying, you know, the only kind of lifestyle to have in the world is the American consumer lifestyle, right? That's actually the only, like, yeah, other people do other things, but it's not the real way to live. Okay. You know, you can make some arguments about, and for the record and for your listeners, I am American. I'm actually a dual citizen now, but I'm born and raised American. You know, but it is, you know, there are things to recommend about the American lifestyle, without a doubt. But there's lots of things that I would not recommend, and lots of things that even I might recommend, but are not actually suitable to other people. Right? It doesn't mean that they're not human. It doesn't mean that they're not living full lives. It's the same thing with the way that artificial intelligence has been defined around this rational goal-seeking behavior to serve yourself primarily, right? It's like, okay, yeah, there's a lot of interesting and useful things that can come out of that as a model, right? But it's not the only way to behave intelligently in the world, right? And, you know, coming at it from, you know, the perspective of the indigenous people that I work with from my own community, which I'm really just at the beginning stage of really learning what that means anyways. You know, it's not that indigenous people have some lock on the right way to do this, right? It's just that it's easier to see, right? It's easier to understand how the multiple things that go into, for instance, me being considered an intelligent member of the Hawaiian community is not necessarily the same thing as what does it mean to be an intelligent member of, say, American society, right? That there are different measurements about what it means to be intelligent. What does it mean to act in the world in a way that contributes not only to your own well-being, but to the well-being of the community around you and to the territory on which you find yourself? And none of these models, none of the sort of standard AI models are capable of dealing with that kind of complexity. And it's not clear to me that they're able to deal with it in a fundamental sense. Like, I'm just not sure if the way we're going about modeling behavior actually allows us to reflect the complexity of being in the world that is actually the case with human beings in the world. And that's super scary, right? We're building these crazy technologies. You know, the reason why we're going to end up with Skynet is not because Skynet just kind of wakes up and sort of randomly decides that it's going to kill everybody. It's because we're going to build psychopathic robots, right? Sociopathic robots, like machines that are incapable of actually understanding of what's important to actual humans.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, that was That was a bit ranty.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the kind of rant that we engage in on a daily basis. So, you're among friends. I was reading this morning Turing's Computing Machinery and Intelligence again, and things that struck me were that some of the arguments levied against his claims of a possible thinking machine were that it would be impossible for a machine to enjoy strawberries and cream. And it just struck me how British an experience that is anyway, you know, sitting at Wimbledon enjoying your random fruit and lactose. And that this, you know, actually influences the kinds of machines that we build and the way that we can build affinities between machines. And not only does Turing, a product of his time, say, well, you know, what people actually want is an affinity with the machine, then we can identify it as a thinking machine. So that's how we're identifying, I guess, sort of a kind of proto-intelligent machine. And he equates species affiliation with racial affiliation. He says, like affiliations between white men and white men and black men, which I never picked up on at the time and is now kind of fascinating to me. I wanted to pivot a little bit and talk about another concept that people have defined very differently, like intelligence, which is bias. And of course, there are mathematical definitions of bias. And what's fascinating is that it's used in AI ethics quite heavily. It is sort of the go-to word for describing why AI might be harmful. And you've said, like, you know, Carrie and I talk a lot about this, but you've said that maybe it's not the right word for thinking about harms in AI. And you say that the bias in these systems is not a bug, but rather a feature of an interlocking set of knowledge systems designed over centuries to benefit white men first and foremost. And we think this is a really crucial point. So can you explain a bit to our listeners what you mean by this?
It's really difficult, I think, to grasp how enmeshed we are in a whole series of intellectual structures that have been accumulating for a very long time, right? So it's, you know, for instance, it can be really difficult to see, you know, one of my favorite examples is, like, you know, in the States anyways, but I know this happens in other places, or North America, you know, you can see how, you know, fairly predictably, like, what side of town the non-white people end up on, right? But if you're just in that town and that's all you ever see, you're just kind of like, oh, that's kind of weird. I wonder why that happened. And there's little stories that are told locally about why that happened. But when you sort of pull out and you look out over across the country and you start to see the pattern, and then you start digging into the history and you realize it's a crazy morass of legislation, custom, migration patterns, conflict, all these different things that have kind of come together to result in this kind of repeatable pattern, then I think I would hope that you would be like, okay, there's something deeper going on here. And what is the deeper thing that's happening? This just isn't just a series of personal choices made by the people who live in those different parts of town. And it's the same thing with our computational systems, right? So, you know, we've defined bias in a way that's amenable to computation, right? So we've defined bias in a way that it's dealt with mathematically, right? And that it can be corrected mathematically, right? But that's not actually bias in the real world, right? So the idea is that the bias is in there because, you know, you've sort of introduced something into your sampling, or something is in your sampling, or you've introduced in your sampling, or something is in your data, right? That is sort of like kind of skewing the proper way that things should function. But really, what that misses is the fact that the system can be working properly from a mathematical standpoint, from a computational standpoint, which can still be horribly biased in its consequences. Right. And so this is the thing, right? I mean, I'm happy to see that we've kind of gotten past this a little bit, like in the industry anyways, right? Is like, you know, for 5 years, they're just throwing up their hands and saying, oh, shit, okay, sorry, you know, we didn't realize that that data was in there, and we didn't understand that, you know, this algorithm was biased in this particular way, and let us just go in and monkey around a little bit and we're going to correct that. And it's like, well, no, now it's just like when you take up that scope of looking across North America, where you're like, okay, wait a second. It's not just because this particular algorithm was not quite constructed correctly, or this particular data set had some bad data in it. It's because you guys are persistently and systematically doing something wrong. And if you're not doing something wrong by your own light, within your own context, so if you look at the math and you look at the algorithm and you look at the data and you're like, those are all like everything's nice and clean and perfect there, right? So there can't be bias, then you're looking at the wrong level of the problem. And just because you're an engineer doesn't mean that you get excused from not going up a level to try to understand the systematic problems with the way that you're approaching things, right? And this is all fractal, right? It's all, you know, it's turtles all the way down, right? Like whichever level you go at, you can see this happening, you know? And like at the high level, you know, I would argue that a bias in the system is that we think it's okay to systematically survey people, right? Particularly a problem in the UK, right? Like somewhere along the line, it was deemed totally acceptable to put up cameras, CCTVs everywhere, hook them together into central systems and set up something where you can like survey an entire town, right? So that's not bias necessarily in the cameras or in the facial recognition software that's in the camera. That's a bias in the systems above that says that this is an acceptable way to run your society. When really it should be like, no. This is not acceptable. It's not acceptable in the way that we don't think it's acceptable for somebody to walk down the street randomly punching people, right? Technically, it's feasible, right? We could be like, that's okay, but we've decided on a values basis, this is not an acceptable way to behave with each other. And so, you know, oftentimes, you know, people building these systems, you know, they make an appeal to the law, it's legal, or they make appeal to customs, like everybody does it. And that, you know, they use it as a way to escape. I'm not even so cynical to think, I don't think they use it necessarily as a way to escape responsibility, but they use it as a way to escape having to think more deeply and better about the problem. And we keep doing it. You know, we let friggin' Tesla run basically live experiments in the public. And basically, we're willing to accept the costs when accidents happen. Because the cost isn't borne by you or me or by Tesla in any meaningful way.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of breaking that association between inaccuracy and bias, as if something bias was something that could be just corrected. We had a really great chat with N. Catherine Hales, and she was talking about also the relationships that she developed with engineers and how enthusiastic data scientists and engineers working in AI were to be confronted with some of these questions. And that's something wonderful that you're doing with the Interdisciplinary Research Grant, with the Indigenous Working Group, is that you bring together people from lots of different backgrounds, from the humanities, from the social sciences, from the sciences. So you've got engineers and artists working together to rethink AI, which is, I think, such an exciting thing for people from all disciplines to come together and realize that, you know, your work can be so much more than just programming instructions. You know, that it really is conceptual, and kind of recognizing the conceptual aspect of AI as world building. So I'd love to hear in these final moments a bit more about that. Could you tell us about the Indigenous Working Group and the challenges and successes of working with lots of different people with very different experiences and backgrounds who have many different things they want to achieve in this space?
Absolutely. First, I just want to say is Catherine is one of my heroes. I think she's been one of the most perceptive, you know, sort of critical observers of how we're actually developing and using technology, you know, for, you know, decades. at this point. And I think that that's one of the things that's important to remember is that, you know, none of the criticisms that are coming out right now really directed at AI are new, right? So sociologists and linguists and other social scientists have been talking about the ways in which our computational systems are a reflection of our value systems, you know, for quite a long time now. And it's really too bad that, you know, we have to be sort of repeating those critiques, you know, with this latest wave of technology. But one of the things I was lucky to learn very as a just a little newbie researcher, so in my early 20s, working at a place called Institute for Research on Learning, which was a really intensely interdisciplinary place, very unusual for the time, where we had linguists, sociologists, physicists, engineers, writers, huge range of disciplines present in the institute. And we would get together once a week and we would look at like 5 minutes of videotape of, say, air traffic controllers doing their job or insurance adjusters doing their job, you know, using computer systems to try to understand what was going on, and spend an entire afternoon on just that 5 minutes, sometimes just 30 seconds, with everybody talking about what they saw. So the linguist talking about the language that was being used, the anthropologist sort of looking at the culture of the air traffic control booth, of the engineers talking about the actual systems that they were using, and realizing how powerful and exciting it was to be able to get access to those contextual frames for understanding the reality that was in front of you and understanding how that reality really shifted as you changed frame. And also just being around a group of people who, you know, came from these very like academically distant points, who were generous and kind and excited about sharing those frames of reference, I think taught me really early about the value of trying to create those spaces where those conversations can be had and people feel comfortable having them. And so it's something I've tried to take with me, you know, as I move through the career, my career, and in particular around the Indigenous Protocol and Artificial Intelligence workshops. It was really clear to Noe, Suzanne, Archer, and I, when we were writing the essay, that we needed to get other people involved in this conversation. That both on the community side, and that always this, I think, obligation. And obligation is kind of too hard of a word because it's something that's taken on willingly, but an obligation to be in conversation with our communities, not to take a position of like, oh, I'm, you know, I just laugh thinking about it, right? I'm going to represent, you know, Hawaiian perspectives, right? Or Archer being like, I'm going to represent Cree perspectives. Like, no, right? You know, he's a Cree person that's representing his particular experience as a Cree person and what he knows about Cree language and culture, you know, in this conversation, as well as what he knows as somebody that's been building his own digital performance technology for 3 decades, right? And so the question was like, how do we bring more diverse voices into this question, into this question of what we want to do with AI? And that's what we did with the workshops and that with the position paper that came out of that. And now, you know, the challenge is, okay, for me, the challenge is, okay, so how do we actually make working groups that actually bring together, for instance, we did a very prototype workshop at MIT last fall with Scott Bennett and Abandan, who's one of the contributors to the Indigenous Protocol and AI position paper and the working group, and a professor, a computer science professor at MIT called Jim Glass, who does work on computational linguistics, and Alan Corbier, who is an Anishinaabe language keeper, where the model there was like, how do we bring Indigenous knowledge practices into conversation with, let's just say, AI knowledge practices, to make it simple at the moment, so that we might be able to find interesting ways in which these knowledge practices can work productively together, right? And then my main goal, my main priority is for the benefit of Indigenous communities, But like I said earlier, I also think there will be a benefit for the other side of that equation, right? Meaning the technical field, right? In terms of making better systems, right? And we can only do that if we get these multiple voices in the room together, right? We can't do that by having the technical people make systems, you know, and then, you know, if you're lucky, get some feedback from the people who are using it so they can tweak it around the edges, right? And on our side, you know, we want, I mean, most of the people that I talk to is we want to take advantage of these technologies. It's not a, you know, it's not a Luddite argument. It's not an argument about, oh, we need to like just put these technologies aside, right? It's an argument about these are incredibly powerful tools. As Indigenous people, we've survived by adapting to new technologies as well as developing our own new technologies. So how do we adapt this technology to better suit us for now? And then over the longer term, how do we build the capacity within our communities to create this technology on our own? So we can build systems from the ground up that reflect the ways in which we want to create intelligent entities in the world to help us, to work with us, to play with us, to create with us, you know, to show us ways of understanding and looking at the world that we have little or no access to, right? And so this is one of the, you know, one of the people that, one of the interesting conversations I had was with somebody, sort of a knowledge keeper, who was talking about how the ability, you know, so one of the things that machine learning and big data is really good at, right, is seeing these patterns that we just can't, they're either too small, right? They're happening at too small of a scale or too large of a scale for us as humans to really apprehend, right? We can't see them in the first place. And even if we might be able to see them, we can't actually really manipulate them to really figure out what they mean, right? That's what big data and machine learning is really, really great at. You know, he was like, you know, this isn't any different than like having a vision, right? It's not any different than having, you know, an experience that you can describe in different ways that allows you to sort of apprehend patterns in the flow of life around you that you can't see in your everyday life, right? He's like, yeah, it's done really differently. He said, but what's exciting is those machines are going to see things that I can't see, right? And those are part of our reality. What they see are part of our reality too. And so we should be excited about having another set of views onto reality, you know? And because reality is a complicated place. And the more we learn, the more complicated it becomes, right? It was supposed to get simpler, right? We were supposed to figure it all out by now. Right? Supposed to have figured out mathematics, supposed to have figured out physics, like it was all converging. We're all going to have a unified model, right? We were going to have one system of mathematic, what are they called? Not postulates, but you know what I'm saying, right? That we're going to cover everything. And then it was like, oh crap. Right? It's like, oh, well, we actually can't have a complete mathematical system where we can prove everything in that system is true from within that system. Can't do that. Physics is like, you guys thought you were talking about matter. Actually, really, you're talking about energy, right? And we actually really don't understand how the energy is working, you know? And it's funny because, you know, you kind of get the sense of there's frustration, for instance, in both of those communities around the fact that everything can't be unified. And I'm like, that's glorious, right? It's not like it hasn't kept us from making useful stuff, right? Creating good technology, you know, but it's kind of glorious that the world is that messy. And the more perspectives that we can bring to the question of understanding our world, you know, the better off we'll be, you know, the more of the world we'll be able to grasp and the more of human experience we'll be able to honor in how we build our technologies and what our technologies respond to. And you got to have, you know, you got to have a diverse set of people in the room to do that. It's just, there's just no other way to do it. It's, you know, as we all know, and the research has shown really well, you know, you end up with, you work with a homogenous project team and you get locked into your own assumptions and you make really stupid fucking mistakes, right? That from somebody outside of your bubble would look out and say, that's a really stupid fucking mistake. Why did you do that? Right? But inside, you've all like convinced each other that this is the greatest thing ever and that, you know, this is the right way to do it and that everybody's going to love this. And who wouldn't want this, you know, sitting on their kitchen table? And, you know, I saw there was a great talk. I was part of a panel in Greece for this Humanity and AI conference. And I forgot who said it now. So I forgive me, whoever said it on my panel. But she was talking about how she was like, you know, I just can't imagine that if the technology around, for instance, autonomous vehicles arose someplace, somehow in the global south, that the first thing that people thought to do would be to figure out self-driving cars, right? As opposed to figuring out, you know, vehicles for moving large numbers of people. You know, like it's those sorts of things where, you know, you just have to scratch your head and be like, oh, okay, so everybody, the engineers, the funders, right, they all thought this is like the most exciting thing they could do with incredible brain power and the incredible amount of money that they have at their disposal. You know, and it's like, wow, okay, we'd be, as you know, as the slogan rose up after the rocket ships went up into space, it's like, we need better billionaires. Right? Like, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem myself with billionaires, right? But, you know, God, they're really uncreative. They really lack imagination. You know, they're just fulfilling a Western science fiction fantasy that's, you know, 100, 150 years old. And it's so boring. That's what amazes me, right? It's just like, oh my God. And I know, you know, I still know people in the Valley and, you know, funders and engineers. And it's just like, are you guys not bored out of your skull? Right? Like at the globe, at the big level, at small level, right? We can all lose ourselves in really interesting technical challenges. Right? And it's awesome. Right? But at the level that you would think that they operate at, you know, I just really wonder sometimes what they're so excited about.
Well, they're all reading the same books. I mean, this is the the kind of the interesting thing. And Karen and I do some work with narratives around AI, so how people imagine AI. And, you know, we would love people to also read different books. And my PhD was in science fiction written by women in Europe. And the first question I get is, oh, women write science fiction? You're like, of course, so much of it. Also, other parts of the world, amazing science fiction that may not be identifiable as science fiction within the Western canon, right? Because it doesn't pertain to those same tropes. And I know that there's a lot of like incredible discussions around indigenous science fiction or indigenous speculative fiction in that area. Well, we have come to the end of our time and it's been incredibly interesting to hear you speak. So thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you very soon, hopefully in person at some point.
This has been a real pleasure for me, Carrie and Eleanor, and I really appreciate you being willing to listen to me rant for an hour. And I think you guys are doing great work with the Good Robot podcast. So look forward to more.
Thank you so much.
This episode was made possible thanks to our generous funder, Christina Gould. It was written and produced by Dr. Eleanor Drage and Dr. Carrie Macrath, and edited by Laura Zamulio-Neaton.